So this was once an essay, but it got lost in autoethnography and has so ended up as a fictional rant. So I'm on a train, travelling from New York to DC to meet my boyfriend. By the time I arrive, he will be done with work and we will have all the ingredients needed for the hilarity of our weekend. This is the life I dreamed would be the compensation for me having managed to live beyond the bruise left over from my youth. The past at last has been left behind. And as if to validate this feeling, the train staggers with happy relief out of the dark tunnel along which, beneath the Hudson River, we have just managed to escape from the constricted hell of Penn Station. The always unexpected marshlands of this part of New Jersey, not usually figured in anyone's idea of beauty, spring forth nevertheless like a revelation. The contrast is rendered with such skill that it feels like grace. But back there under the river, we had felt our way along haltingly, as if through the labyrinth of some archaic past that modern life were trying to forget. For a minute, the lights had cut out, and we had spontaneously descended towards silence. We became a community founded on a constitution both luminous and sonic through a mysterious dimming of light and turning down of volume. I was reminded of those films about World War II that I watched on TV on rainy afternoons as a child. Allied prisoners of war, all hushed whispers and silent pantomime, chiseling out their escape tunnel using their tin canteens. And just as suddenly, the crossing has been made and I am travelling once more in the light towards my dream. I settle down to reverie, unlocking the doors and turning off alarms so that other thoughts from elsewhere might quietly wander through. And, as if to ridicule the openness of my trust, I am immediately attacked and robbed. A woman is talking on her phone. Edging along back there, under the Hudson, we had caught each other's gaze, she and I, and we had held that moment in the quiet dark. It is rare when, without flinching, you can see another and be seen yourself. It is usually too shaming, necessitating flight or hasty approach with weapons or garlands or whatever else love and hate must offer to cover up this thing exposed. And so one can only stumble inadvertently upon such a clearing within the dense thicket of the contemporary. Usually there are no maps. Since no one enjoys being seen to be guilty of being lost, the woman quickly rights herself once the lights return and reboots her spectacle with the charge provided by the certainty of her phone talk. I want her to stop. And yet, I am sick with speculation, like some anthropologist obscenely gripped by whatever mischief he thinks the natives are up to. Indeed, let me tell you what she's up to. She wants to be an image, once more, of someone who knows just where she is. It is the active making of her sounds that allow her to be visualized as such in her imagination, and for her to imagine me visualizing her likewise. Her phone is both secret alibi and unacknowledged prosthesis for the full spectacle of this image. It is rhetorical technology, part of the arts by which she persuades me of that busy self of hers that has just been reborn in the bright, sunlit marshlands of New Jersey. It is ridiculous. But I feel betrayed. I had thought we both wanted something else, an escape of sorts. But she pretends now that she'd merely wanted to escape, as if the tunnel's only hope were that it would rescue her by returning her to where she had just come from, to where a phone signal could be caught. Since her sounding voice has made the environment no longer suitable for my reverie, the only thing that grows in this noise-polluted atmosphere is a toxic undergrowth of weeds. My projections, irritations, brutal hypotheses, disgust, muttered condemnations. Nothing cultivated here is fit for consumption. I look in dismay at this garden of mine. Me, a gay man who has spent his life surrounded by women, now spouting rancid stereotypes, a woman hated because she can't shut the fuck up. If I do not quickly hack these thoughts back,
They will flourish fast and bear forth furious fruit. I should start gardening now. But I feel way too violent to perform such violence on the only plants left for me to farm. I cannot murder the demon that is all of me remaining. And anyway, why should I? Just so this paltry, nattering thing might continue meaninglessly to gab, if it had been her intention to desecrate, then we could have had a war. But having had my garden inadvertently trampled on by a human merely drunk on phone, the only agency to which I now have recourse remaining is that of wonky imitation of the very thing that perturbs. And so my imagination unreins berserk speculations, drunk on a self-destructive madness to trample her world into the ground. It is her partial innocence of her crime that is so darkly inspiring, such magnificent fertilizer for the angry brambles that have started to swell, drowning the princess in her tower in a thicket where she dreams in her sleep about my boyfriend the prince. What a bitch! That princess stole my dream, just like that woman on her phone. What a bitch! First, it's empowering. You announce that you are going to try and get well, and everyone says, good for you. People rally round, which ultimately turns out to be embarrassing, since you remain sick. You can't help wondering if all these well-wishers are starting to suspect that you're not trying hard enough. They tell you that you are such a wonderful, wonderful person. You deserve to let yourself be well so that you can enjoy your beautiful, beautiful life. And you feel touched to know that they are waiting for you at the harbour for your boat to dock. But since you remain at sea, you start to feel that they think that you are a bit stupid, and that they are thus quietly relieved that you will never make it to their dry land. Angry at being spurned, you therefore start a small war, pummeling their shore with missiles, and only when the ultimate impotence of your endeavours has left you exhausted do you wonder if your inability to get well might not be a commitment of sorts, a commitment to some kind of truth, perhaps. The idea that sickness is a prerequisite for access to truth is hardly new, and the pages of academic books seem more than happy to offer hospitality to all things sick. We might be cynical and say that sick objects of investigation make very marketable intellectual commodities indeed. But whilst the academy accommodates the study of sickness, it really wants to be sick itself. It remains a little bourgeois. It wants to have its cake and eat it, its being and its health. A bloodless revolution. Indeed, I am not completely out of sympathy with this desire to remain well. After all, celebration of what, for the celebrated sick, may just be unendurable life seems to me quite repellent. Yet it is not irrelevant to note that whilst the Academy defends the sick and honours the revelations to which only the sick can make us privy, it nevertheless tends to uphold a distinction between its adulation and potential emulation. Even the stylistic experiments of a Nietzsche, Benjamin, or Adorno, or Derrida are often only vaunted from the safety of the observation point. There's one sound for them and another sound for us. And so start sounding like the animals in the jungle, and you might find yourself drinking alone at the next academic conference you attend. You have to make the right kind of sound. It's more important than what you actually say. But what if a woman is speaking on her phone, eh? What if some possibly unknowable obscenity in the object, such as its sound, bends the arc of one's perception in such a way that they boomerang back to hit one repeatedly in the head? In such a situation, you can never get at it. It merely gets at you. And so you can never get beyond yourself and thus always remain within its confines. When in good health, academic knowledge tends to displace things in order to offer them a better home within the protective enclosure of the known. But when a woman is talking on her phone, you remain too much with the thing, too much in place, And paradoxically, this place then starts to feel like nowhere at all, a displacement that is in place. It is not that you don't have access to any information or input, quite the contrary. You are inundated. And so, like the sick, you become massively oversensitive to stimuli, as if your skin had been flayed or your ear become sore with tumescence. Tormented, you are nevertheless a genius of fine-tuned perceptions, and as you burn in your hell, you laugh with scorn at the thug-blunt imprecision of the Neanderthal average constituting academic sensibilities. You are hysteric, borderline, traumatized, demonic, and magnificent. You are ill. Where did I come from that I should find myself so caught in a cage of someone else's sound? The other passengers on this train seem perfectly unperturbed. They are at home, in place, whereas I'm endlessly crumpling up and unfurling a piece of paper in the invisible hand of a bored fate. If only I could read what's written upon that sheet, I might then know who I am and why I am this way. But I have no such agency. I can only keep repeating to myself that a woman is talking on her phone, as if that sheer fact were definitive prosecution of her crime. Fury, after all, wins by assertion, not argument. To others, I may well seem at peace, but I am in fact in a zoo court, screaming this phrase inside my head to counteract the sound of this woman, who for me might as well be screaming too. I am the loudest absence of sound, the unendurable cliche of a deafening silence. Across the aisle, a late middle-aged couple are smiling benignly and pointing things out to each other through the window. They are old enough to appreciate the rest that comes from sitting down, but not so decrepit that their comfy chairs have become prisons. In front of them, by contrast, a little boy has turned his seat into a trampoline, and his mother laughs as if she were watching a circus act. When the two of them go off to the cafe car on a foraging adventure to fuel, excuse me, his antics, the child insists on being carried. A seat for him is for exercise, and walking, by comparison, an aristocratic opportunity to rest in the arms of his adult slave. It's all upside down, but the two of them seem happy enough with their topsy-turvy arrangement. I'm upside down too, making sounds that no one can hear. A woman is talking on her phone! And hearing things, a woman talking on her phone, that other people don't acknowledge and so might as well not exist. Am I a child too? If I, as an adult, become a child, then at that moment, I also come from my past. It is as if I were now two beings at once, holographically superimposed. Sitting on this train, condemned to exile by a woman talking on her phone, my foreignness is therefore temporal, not topographical. I am in a condition of historical abandonment, as one can sometimes be in psychoanalysis, when an ancient fear, long thought to have been stowed away in the toy cupboard of one's early years, unexpectedly topples out from a seemingly unrelated, mundane narrative, collapsing time and reducing one to tears. And yet it's just an artifice, just a toy, just a puppet, just a woman talking on her phone. What past haunts me here? Who have I become when on her phone she speaks?
I shall read it instead. It was going to come off my phone, but the phone is broken. So imagine this coming from a phone.
You want a couple of hands like this?
It's time for some hypnosis. So let's look at this map of America in the 19th century. In the east, you will note that all big cities are marked by a small blob of mercury, each a Tiffany tear cast from finest silver. Now note the years churning round and the slightly sick feeling they give birth to in your gut. Hear the sound they make as they eat their way across the plains of time, louder and louder from east to west, dawn to dusk, sun to moon, infinite repeat from one century to the next. Hear, as the rumble swells, it sets a quiver the skin of each bright mercury globe until the volume makes a surface break and mirrored yoke slides out in scuttle along the furrowed nerves that twitch and clank across the continent. Louder and louder. From east to west, dawn to dusk, sun to moon, infinite repeat from one century to the next. Look at the body of the nation covered with its silver veins. Look, and see before you, see America. The great transfusion once flowed with blood and now with metal scraped. See the trains eat their way across the plains, louder and louder, from east to west, dawn to dusk, sun and moon, infinite repeat from one century to the next. Note the sick feelings they give birth to in the guts of those who, still and quiet, as if they were trying to procure the trust of wild animals, await the train's approach from across the landscape there unfurled, before the borders of their world. Look, see, come on. We all know that sound has magic powers, and that anything that can make a sound therefore has a mouth, and that any mouth can become the host to someone else's mouth. That's why you should always eat with your mouth closed. Talk a lot on your phone, do you, love, eh? Well, watch it. If you leave the door open long enough, something will eventually wander in, and then you'll have another mouth in your lap. And then what will you do, eh? So, like, a woman is talking on her phone, right? Know what I mean? You can hear her, but you don't have to listen, right? You can choose one way or the other. Hear, listen. You don't have to be like that middle-aged gay man over there rolling his eyes, looking around, shaking his head, sighing, irritated. Fucking faggot. They're all the fucking same, innit? Always acting as if they were singing a tune in some goddamn fucking soap opera. Gawd, life's difficult enough as it is without making everything such a bloody performance. It's just a fucking woman talking on her phone, for Christ's sake. A woman is talking on her phone. I look around at the other passengers on the train. It's not that they don't know that she is talking. It is rather that it doesn't seem to matter to them one way or the other whether she is or not. After all these years, I still want to be like them. But there is some devil in this woman's sound that tempts me with the possibility that if I made a sound too, her sound might stop. I am tortured by this thought. I must work hard not to hallucinate that I have already broken my vow, opened my mouth and shouted, "Shut the fuck up!" The imagined words hang in the air for me as if some tiny plane had written them there in coloured smoke. Neither sound nor silence, just script, writing. And the background bars of the tiny plane flying off to expose some other faggot's shame. Madly, I look around to make sure no one has read this script I crave to transform into sound. If only this drama can remain a secret theatre, I might still get off this stage and belong to their world, a comfortable member of the audience to life. But a man across the aisle has read my discomfort. And I am now doubly embarrassed, caught in the important nowhere between what I desire to act sonically and my fear of doing so. Damned by the writing of that tiny plane, I have no choice but to attempt to a cure from the poison. And so I take out my pen and start to write. I am on a train, traveling from New York to DC to meet my boyfriend. By the time I arrive, he will be done with work and we will have all the ingredients needed for the hilarity of our weekend. This is the life I dreamed would be the compensation for me having managed to live beyond the bruise left over from my youth, the past at last has been